Okay, great. So it's a small group, so I like to make it totally conversational, so you can ask all kinds of questions. We'll see where we go. You might want to listen to tomorrow's also, because I'm sure it'll be different, especially seeing the group that's here, what you're interested in. So we're going to talk about the journey of the soul, and I'm willing to go where you'd like to go with souls. There's so much interesting stuff, so I'll give you some introductions, and you can totally interrupt and ask questions along the way. So I want to start out with, here's a Pesach thought, but it pertains to what we're going to talk about, and you'll see why. So we have in the center of our Seder table, we have the Kos Eliyahu, the Elijah's cup, right? Who knows why we have it?
Keep the kids interested.
Ah, that's a good, that's a possibility, right? Keep the kids interested.
Just in case he should ever appear.
Sure. Right, so there is the classic kids song, don't shake the table, don't shake the table, watch that cup of wine, because I want to see the wine goes down when it's Eliyahu's time. Right, so that's not why. We don't believe in Santa Claus. We don't think he's going to come and take a drink from the cup. Okay, so we have four cups of wine at the Seder table. And those four cups are opposite four different languages of redemption that are in a verse. But actually, in that verse, there's five languages of redemption. The fifth one is Veheveti, I'll bring you into the land. But we're not in the land yet, for the final in the land. So we don't know what to do with that fifth word. Do we pour and drink a cup for that or not? So what we do is we pour the fifth cup, but we don't drink it. Because we're not sure what to do. What's the halacha on that? It's a question mark. And we have question marks in halacha. We have question marks in hashkafa. But those question marks, it's not that there's not an answer to it. There is an answer. We just don't know it. Mm. Eliyahu knows the answers. And when he comes, he's going to resolve the question. He'll resolve all those question marks in halacha. And we'll know what to do. So that cup, that Elijah's cup in the middle of the table, is a big question mark right in the middle of our Seder table. Right at the time that we are passing on our information from one generation to the next. In the center of the table, we are saying, by having that cup, there's some stuff we don't know. And that doesn't stop our transmission of Torah. We transmit what we do know. We know there's answers. We don't know them all. But when Eliyahu comes, he's going to fill us in on the rest of the details that we're missing. But here is an example of, we don't know the answer to this one. So that's for halacha. And it's rare that we don't know what to do. And it's very rare to have a compromise in halacha like that. That's one of the few examples of an actual compromise. Pour it, but don't drink it, because we're not sure. Usually we figure out, you either do it or you don't do it. But in hashkafa, in Jewish philosophy, there's lots of question marks. Halacha, Jewish law, or the way you walk and behave, has to have a definitive answer. You need help opening? Who's really strong? Maybe it is a defective one. I'll take a different one. In halacha, you have to know what to do. Just because she was doing a chesed, she had all that extra power of being kind to another.
Thank you, Chach.
Anyway, when it comes to halacha, you have to know what to do, so there has to be an answer. But when it comes to hashkafa, Jewish thought or philosophy, there does not have to be a definitive answer. So that's important to know as we embark on our conversation about souls. Because I'm going to share with you one strong stream of thought within Jewish thought. There are other streams of thought. It doesn't mean this is the only right one, and it doesn't mean ones that oppose this are wrong. We don't actually know for sure. But I'm going to share with you, based on the thoughts of the Ramban, Nachmanides, and as embodied in the writings of Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, the Ramchal, in his book Derech Hashem. Most of this information comes from that, although some comes from other places. But let's just start with that. Okay, so the word for soul in Hebrew is neshama, as you know. Neshama is related to the word breath, neshima. Right? So linshof and linshom is to breathe. So neshama is neshima, a breath, because Hashem, because it says in the verse, which I didn't bring a Tanakh with me and I should have, in Genesis 2:7, in that verse, it says, and he blew into him the breath of life, right? Nishmat chayim. So that's the first place where we see the word nishama, nishmat chayim, the soul of life. So the question is, what is that soul of life? What does it do? And how does it work? And there's a lot of different theories on it. So even though we're going to share the theories of the Ramban, I just want to tell you a little bit about the theory of the Rambam for a second. So the Rambam, Maimonides, held that there is one soul that's divided into five parts and has five different functions. And if you want to learn more about it, you can look in Shmona Prakim, the eight chapters, which is the Rambam's introduction to the Mishnah. And that whole thing, it turns out, is about souls and how souls work. So the Rambam, as a physician, felt that, as we all know, any of us moms who are worried about nutrition or try to learn about it, the more you know, the more you can manipulate it, the more you can understand it, the more you can affect your body by what you eat. That's important to know, right? Or the rest of our health. The more we understand our bodies and how they work, the better we can function with them. So the Rambam, as a physician, felt the same thing about souls. If you'll understand your soul and its different parts and the way it works, you'll understand how to use it better, take care of it better, function with it better. So that's based on that thought is why we're looking at tonight. But we don't really go by Rambam's view of the soul, that there's just one and it's divided into five parts. And his five parts include digestion. It's interesting just to see the way he divides it out. It's very different than the way we're going to divide it out. Anyway, he holds there's one. Other philosophies hold that there is two, an animal soul and a human soul. And we're going to go with the stream of thought that says that there's two, an animal soul and a human soul, but that the human soul is divided into five parts. They're not the same five parts as what the Rambam says. So we'll get to that. But you should just know that there's two different streams of thought there, two major streams within Judaism, a one-soul concept and a two-soul concept. So we're going to go with the two-soul concept. Okay, so the question is, let's just start with, when does the soul come into the body? So, because we know that the body is formed and then the soul comes into it. They're not necessarily formed at the same time. So we have a word, an English word, called ensoulment, of when the soul comes into the body. And different religions have different time frames for when they believe this occurs, right? So the Catholics believe right at the moment of conception.
Like the 40th day.
Right, so ours is right, so... but before we go there, you just have the joke, right? So what's the Jew's definition of when the fetus is viable?
When he's in graduate school.
Yeah, that's right. When he graduates med school, right? Exactly.
Is that true? Is that a joke?
That's the joke, yeah. Right. But that's not actually our definition of when the ensoulment occurs. That is 40 days. 40 days after conception is when we understand ensoulment happens. And it's interesting just to look at the science. Also, we see that there is a hormone wash that happens over the brain at 40 days where there's a distinguishing between the genders at that time. It's kind of a non-gender specific blob until 40 days. And then that's when it differentiates into either male or female is at about 40 days physically. But that's when we hold the soul goes in. Okay, so the soul... if it comes in, and we'll talk more about it coming in, but we have this understanding that the soul, we are created in the image of God. So if we're created in the image of God, it doesn't mean physical, although there is something about our physical image also that corresponds to God, although God is not physical at all. So it can't be that our physical shape is like the shape of God, because God doesn't have a shape. But it certainly means that beyond our physical shape, who we are is in the image of God. So one of the ways that we're in the image of God is that we are unique, like God is unique. There's nothing else like God, and there's nothing else like us. Nothing else converges exactly like us. We're 100% unique. But also the fact that we can be givers and make a difference through giving. The fact that we can use speech to create. God chose to use speech as a pathway of creation. So it is something that we can use to create and to destroy. Right, so we're the only creature that has speech the way that we have it. Other animals can communicate, but not through speech. And it is a force of destruction and of creation and destruction. The ability to impact on the world, to create, I mean, all mammals, all animals can create, but not necessarily the way that we can. So everybody can reproduce. They can all create life in that sense. So we can have a kid too. Okay. But nobody else can impact on the world, build a jet plane, tear a hole in the ozone layer, right? Or fix certain things. Like, nobody can do what we can do, have that level of impact. So we have been entrusted with a power of creation and destruction, because they come together. That's different. And all of these relate to Hashem. So there is one thing about Hashem, though, which is that Hashem, how many Hashems are there?
One.
One, right? not just that there's one, but that there's a oneness about Hashem that's completely unique. Also, that Hashem is indivisible. That it's in a way, it's like Hashem is solid state. It doesn't have moving parts. Like there's nothing you can tease apart. It's just a one Hashem through and through. We look at Hashem through different angles at different places, and we'll say that's Hashem's mercy, that's Hashem's anger, that's Hashem's whatever it is, but really Hashem is one and totally blended, indivisible, can't be separated out. So in order for us to be created in the image of Hashem, we have to be created as one. So our souls and our bodies were created as one. So that's why the original Adam creature was an androgynous being, created as one, male and female in one creature, and then divided into all the other mammals on the planet were created in pairs, male and female in pairs, and they went on. But only human beings were created as one androgynous being and then divided into, because our physical form reflects God also, and we had to be created as one. There's reasons that we had to be divided, but then we have to get back into oneness also to emulate God. But our soul, too, was created as one. So the Gemara in Nida, Tractate Nida, says that our soul was created as one, and then basically, just for imagining sake, but it's not exactly like this, so don't keep this as an image. Basically, one soul torn in half, half sent into a male baby, half sent into a female baby, and hopefully about 20 years later, you find your soulmate, right? The other half of your soul, hopefully. And then you get married, and the work of marriage is to knit those two soul halves back together. Right, to create one. So you're created as one, divided in two, and then you have to get back to being one. Right, so that's the 1-2-1 here. The soul is created as one, divided in two, has to get back into being one. The initial human body was created as one, is then divided in two, and physically we get back into being one too. It's interesting just to see, you know, our message as Jews in the world is Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, right, that oneness of Hashem. You could tie that into the Megillah, where Haman says there is a one nation. There's a nation of oneers, is a way to read it, right? There's an Am Echad. We're the Echad nation, the nation of oneness. That's our message. We're just constantly giving that, hopefully, giving that message of oneness, oneness, oneness. Right, so that's our message. So when it says in the Torah, first the Adam creature was one, then divided in two, and then they're told to go back and become one flesh, right? V'hayu l'basar echad, become one flesh. So you can also read that as through becoming one flesh, v'hayu l'basar echad, v'hayu l'vaser echad, you shall proclaim oneness. Right, livaser, like v'sirot tovot, you know that word, v'sirot tovot?
Mivaser, too.
Right, mivaser, right, so livaser is to proclaim. So it's the same word as basar, we're proclaiming in our flesh, depending, there's all kinds of things to learn about. But anyway, you're supposed to proclaim oneness. So taking two soul halves, taking two body halves, and bringing them back into one is the way to proclaim oneness in the world, to become one is the way to emulate God. Okay, so we have this one soul, our one soul, divided into, we're supposed to make it back into one. But really we have a concept of one soul of all humanity. So there's Adam and Eve, or there's the Adam creature before he's been divided into Adam and Eve. That's the one soul, and we understand Kabbalistically that that one soul is the root of every single human being on the planet. That soul is basically shattered into a million sparks, and each one of us has it. Okay, so then how does that make us different than non-Jews? Right, so there is a different Jewish soul than non-Jewish soul, and yet all of us trace our roots back to Adam and Eve. So we have to figure out that piece too. How did that work out that there is actually a separate Jewish soul source? So we also have a concept, just to add in extra questions before we answer, according to this theory. There's a concept that there's 600,000 Jewish souls, and that all of those souls were at Sinai, and they received the Torah all at the same time. So you tell me, how many Jews were at Sinai? More than 600,000. We understand that there are 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60, right? But there are also males under the age of 20 and males over the age of 60 and parallel women. So basically the figure that we usually use is about 3 million. There are about 3 million people. So if there's 600,000 souls, so even in the moment of receiving the Torah, those souls were divided among 3 million people. But if we understand that there's 600,000 souls all together for the Jewish people, so you really have to take all the Jewish people throughout time and take that number and divide it into 600,000 and get soul chips in a way, that each one of us has a soul chip. Let's leave that for just a second. How do we go from one soul to 600,000 souls, from an all humanity soul to a Jewish soul? So it was an interesting process, actually, of transformation that occurred through the double process of Egypt and Sinai. So Egypt in Hebrew is Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim means the root of the word, the center of the word is tsar, narrow, like tsuris, difficulties, when people have difficulties. So it's a narrowness. So when people have a difficulty in their life, it's a narrowness. So basically what happened was, thinking about that narrowness, just leave that for a second in your mind. So for there's Adam, and then up to Abraham is 2,000 years. Who knows the year that Abraham was born? From zero, if we're counting 5773 today. You'll remember it after I say it. 1948.
Oh, the creation of Israel.
Yeah, right? So according to our count today of 2013, 1948 is the creation of the State of Israel. But according to the count of zero, if we're in 5773, Adam was born in 1948 from that zero. Abraham was born in 1948. So basically that's 2,000 years after Adam. Right? So for 2,000 years, Hashem created all humankind to be in a relationship with him. And then for 2,000 years, basically, nobody really worked on serious relationship with God during that time. And we're not going to go into that. It's a whole long discussion. You can hear more if you want to on my website, abiteoftorah.com. I have a whole section on Derech Hashem, 40 classes, which you can listen to if you want, and there's much more information there. But just the quick breeze through, basically you have 2,000 years, and nobody's doing a serious job trying to transform the world through the knowledge of one God, right? Abraham's not the first monotheist. He's the first monotheist with a mission, right? Adam was a monotheist. Noah was a monotheist. Shem and Abram were monotheists. There was a bunch of other monotheists sprinkled throughout history. But Abraham was the first monotheist with a mission, the first one that wanted to change the world because of that knowledge. So basically what happened was mankind was created in a state of tremendous potential. From the first choice that they made, they dropped to a very low state, but their potential remained. They traveled along history like this, with potential up here and reality down here, for 2,000 years until Abraham finally looked up and saw human potential and said, wow, that's totally what I want to accomplish, and I want to bring the world to that. And God said, phew, I have been waiting for somebody to be a monotheist with a mission. Great, I'm going to transform you into the leader of you and your descendants into leaders of the world that are going to bring all humanity into this one God vision. Fabulous. So Abraham basically, I'm paraphrasing completely here, says, how is that going to happen? And God says, don't worry, I have a plan for you. Your descendants are going to be slaves in Egypt and they're going to suffer and have a terrible time and come out with a lot of stuff. What? What kind of answer is that to the question, right? Like, it's a very strange, it's a strange question. So really what God is saying is, I'm going to create a custom designed workshop just for this, because Abraham, you came to this understanding on your own, but your kids didn't, right? So I'm going to create a way for them to come to the understanding on their own, or not, give them an experiential learning workshop where they're going to be able to become my people, just like you made a choice into it. And then we're going to transform the world as a group. We're going to become the group. So, okay, so into Egypt they go. So it's this group that goes in, 70 souls, into Egypt. Now imagine the narrow straits of Egypt. Imagine the old-fashioned kind of washing machine with the wringers, you know, that you would turn the handle, crank the handle, and you would put the clothes through so it would wring it out. So that's the narrow straits of Egypt. We went through that. So they took us as a people, as individuals, and squeezed us out so tight. And it hurt a lot going into slavery and being tortured. And we were squeezed, squeezed, squeezed. But in that state of being totally squeezed, that's how we were whisked out as a nation and brought to Har Sinai, brought to Mount Sinai, where we were allowed to absorb into all those empty spaces that were squeezed out. Then the Torah was absorbed in. So we had a dual process of squeezing out part of regular humanity, and then absorbing in a divine light into those empty spaces that actually did spiritually transconfigure the Jewish soul. It was all by choice until Sinai, at which point anybody who was there was locked into the program. Before Sinai, just throwing this out there, before Sinai you got to pick in every generation. And after Sinai, no more picking. You can pick in, but once you're in, you can never leave. right? So somebody can convert in, somebody can be born in, but once you're in, it's permanent. There is no exit at all. You cannot leave. You could not observe, but you can't leave. So anyway, that is how the 600,000 souls were there. They were transformed at that time, but they were already split among the people who were standing there. So then we have the question of, we do believe in general, again, keeping in mind that Kosei Eliyahu, where we don't know for sure, this is just a very strong theory in Jewish thought that most people agree on in the Jewish world. We do believe in reincarnation. We don't believe in it like the Buddhists, that we just go around and around and around. We believe in it more like reincarnation is a necessary frustration for some. It's a frustration. Reincarnation only comes to people who both deserve it and need it. So it means that you did enough that it's worth it to bring you back, and you didn't do enough that you're required to come back. If you completely blew it, no second chances. If you completely aced it, no need. Right? It's only for the in-betweeners, basically us sitting in this room. We do have an understanding that now we're at the end of days and pretty much all of us are reincarnations fixing up stuff. So it's us, those who accomplished quite a bit and it's worth it to bring us back, but didn't do everything, and so we need to come back, that we have stuff to work on, things to wrinkles to iron out, that we're here. So if we have reincarnation, so we have this concept of being able to recycle souls, and yet 600,000 is still not enough to fill all the Jewish bodies that are walking the planet today, let alone all the other ones that walked before and will walk after us, right? So here is not something from the Ramchal, but something that I did check out with one of my teachers. It's my own personal soul theory, but he said it makes sense. But just makes sense. I'm not saying this is the truth. It's just a theory that makes sense. So this is my soul splinter theory, where you take these 600,000 souls, divide it by however many Jews ever lived, and right, so that makes sense right there. That's straight up math. You have to do that to get the amount of soul splinters that there are for each person to have a soul chunk inside of them. But mix that around with reincarnation. Okay, so now you have a problem. A question that I often get with reincarnation is, okay, so if I'm reincarnated, then when there's the resurrection, whose wife will I be? Mm-hmm. Am I the wife of the husband of this lifetime or of last lifetime?
Never mind if you have multiple spouses and what about your, in this one.
Right, what about multiple spouses in this one? Or children, or whatever. Like, who are you related to? How does that work? So that's where I say, abandon the initial concept that I gave you of the one soul torn in half. It's so neat and tidy, like that, half into a male, half into a female, and now you're just making one soul. You have to know it's much, much more complicated than that. So that's an important vision to have at first as you start learning about souls. But now you have to get that we are one soul as a people, even as a Jewish people. 600,000, but we're still one at its root. We're one soul. And each one of us is a separate expression of, let's say, a ray of that soul. Ray actually is a good word because we talk about ve'ahavta le're'acha kamocha, right? So what's a ray? Ray is a friend, but it also means a broken part, right? So you have, in the shofar blasts, you have tia, shvarim, and trua. Trua has the same root in it, resh ayin. It means broken part. So if really, if you would translate, love your neighbor like yourself, love your friend like yourself, ve'ahavta le're'acha kamocha, really you could translate it as love your broken part like yourself, right? That we are all one. But we're broken into many parts. It looks like we're separate because we're all separated by skin, right? That makes us into our own unit with our own soul chip in it. But the truth is, in a way, it's all a ray emanating from one Jewish soul. That's the concept of all Jews are tied in one to another. All Jews are mixed in one to another because we are all one another. It's just that each one of us shepherds one special aspect of our one whole soul.
So, shepherd being the same shoresh.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't think about that, although that's not what... You're right. That's a cross-cultural shoresh mixing, but you're right, yeah. We do shepherd that one aspect. So now let's think about it this way. So here's where my theory starts, because that's all straight-up math, right? That all works. That's not my theory. That's just my explanation of how it works. Here's my theory. Take that amount, right, the amount of all Jews that ever were and ever will be, that you're going to divide into 600,000 souls. But multiply that by 10 first before you divide it so that you get 10 soul chips for every person that's alive. And now think about reincarnation, that people might have soul stacks of chips mixed up. So you might have 3 in this lifetime and 10 in another, or it could be that you have 10 right now and somebody else has 16, but that the 10 that you have include 1 from your great-grandmother and 1 from your aunt, and that they're, it's restacked and remixed so that, you know, so, you know how people who do past life regressions and stuff like that, everybody was somebody famous, turns out. Everybody was Miriam and had the tambourine ready, you know, or whatever it is. So
you have no stock in any of that?
No, but it's possible. This makes it possible.
Well, if we're all one, then it's a collective, so yeah. Your memory could be...
There is a collective, but also if there's a soul chip theory, so it makes it so, let's say Miriam had, and you can't put a number on it, we're just mixing things up just as a concept. Let's say Miriam had 50 soul chips in her, right? So those soul chips could be spread out among many people that could be reincarnated in stacks of other people's soul chips that they could have had a flavor of Miriam in them. They could be carrying that forward. It's possible. So who knows, whatever that means, and names and how all these things work. There's all kinds of mystical stuff we don't know, which is why I started the whole thing with a big question mark, because it is a big question mark. But there is, we do believe in reincarnation, we do believe in souls, we do believe in multiple souls, we do believe in souls spinning around and being recycled and stuff. So we'll just leave it there. But I want to add one layer onto that. We do also believe in the concept of family souls. That there is a neshama of a family and that each one of us takes our part of the family, which is why we look like members of our family and we have some of the same physical stuff. Let's just say parents to children, right? We look like our parents and we inherit their stuff both physically and psychologically, right? So we'll get their money or their debt or whatever it is, their stuff, their books, I think I have a lovely library, probably close to the size of the shelves that are in the partners in that room over there. Like, I think I have 8 or 9 floor-to-ceiling bookshelves full of books, which I bought carefully over the years for a lot of money. And I look at those books and I think, someday they're going to be in a garage sale, 25 cents each. Take the box for $5, you know. That's where they're all headed, you know. That's where they're going. And I think, you know, so kids, they'll pick what they want. They inherit some stuff and then they let go of stuff. Like, there's stuff to go. How much stuff, especially in today's world where we're all overstuffed, how much stuff can you have and absorb into a household? Even though I have 6 kids, they're not going to want all the stuff that's in my house. So, but they get that stuff, plus they get my stuff. Right? However I do things, like we find that we do things like or in opposition to our parents, mm-hmm. right? So that we still have their stuff, even if we're going against what they did. So we're still dealing with what they did, right? So all of that's part of the family soul concept, that we have a chance to rectify family things. And we see that also in the Megillah. I'll let you, that'll be a different talk that somebody else will give you, but just have it in mind when you learn about Esther and how she has the opportunity to fix her entire father's household full of stuff by her act of going to the king. So I'm just leaving that as a question mark. You'll see that in some other context, but you should know that it has to do with family souls here. Okay, so now let's look at the structure of the soul. Here's where we get to the two souls. So I wrote, as you see on the paper, nefesh twice. So we're going to start with the first nefesh, which is separate from the second nefesh. It's not a typo. So the first nefesh is the animal soul. So the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, writes in his book Derech Hashem that we have an animating life force, which is actually physical. It's the most ethereal of all physical creations. I just read an additional explanation. I'm trying to think who said this. That the animating life force, that nefesh, animal soul, is the force that bonds body and soul together, neshama. So you could circle this nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, yechida. Make a circle around that, or a little bracket. The whole thing together, all those 5, is called neshama. The whole 5-piece thing is called neshama. So the nefesh, that animal thing, is what bonds the neshama, the human soul, to the body. It's bonded together through the nefesh. So dogs have a nefesh, snakes have a nefesh, humans have a nefesh. The animating life force of each one of those things, it's not like we each have the same thing and that's just the thread that ties the other soul in. Animals don't have another soul, bless you. They just have a nefesh. They are all physical. There is nothing, no spiritual component to animals. even though those who have pets, do you have a pet? Yeah, I just noticed in your wistful look, I have a pet too, right? Turns out dogs don't have souls. It's very sad. But when our dog was hit by a car, and then we had to put it down, put her down because it broke her hip in many places. We couldn't be fixed. Anyway, the vet sent us a condolence card. And it was the saddest card, and it was like all about how our dog is healthy and whole, romping in green pastures over the rainbow bridge. And when we cross the rainbow bridge at the end of our days, our dog will be there to greet us. And I'm reading that card and sobbing, thinking it's so sad, but I don't believe it. It's not true. She's gone. Anyway, dogs do not have souls, and they're not romping in pastures over the rainbow bridge. When they're gone, sadly, and it's happy when they're here. But, yeah.
Because I was learning about, like, Pirikshira, where, you know,
There's a life, and, right, they do serve their role, but it's not a soul that says those things. Did you read that there's a soul?
No, it just, I kind of felt like it was implied, like, in there that because they have their feelings, their ideas, their song is kind of like, their songs are soulful.
Yes, but they're not. They're like angels. So there's animals below us and angels above us and the spiritual structure of things. We're in the middle, but we're the only ones who have free will. So angels are basically spiritual robots. They're programmed to do what they do, and they do not have free will. They can't make a choice to not do what they've been programmed to do. Mm-hmm. In a way, they're like, I call them spiritual neurotransmitters. Like, they're just there to carry the will of God into actuality. So they make that transference. It has nothing to do with they don't engage in the process. They just do it. Right, and animals too. That's why they're called behema, ba ma. Behema is ba ma. In it is what it is. That's all it is. It's just that. It's just the physical of what it is. It does have an animating soul, which is physical. It's fascinating to see that the animating soul is where things like fidelity and curiosity live. That's not in the neshama. That's in the animal soul. So that is part of being an animal. And animals don't have free will either. Right? So you won't see a dog looking at the butter dish thinking, it's wrong of me to take that, and so I won't. Right? They're just thinking, where is my owner right now? Can I get that butter before they come back? Right? And they'll be embarrassed if you catch them in the act. But they're still sucking it down as fast as they can if your back is turned, right? I don't know about your dogs, but my dog does, right? They're all over it, but they'll be embarrassed. Like if I leave the house, right, and they think I'm gone, that's when they'll jump on the table and lick the butter off the, right? But if I forgot my recorder or something and I come back in the front door to grab it, they give me a look like, I didn't expect you to come back. I was in the middle of the butter. So, anyway, that's all in the animal soul. That's not in the human soul, okay? We have an animal soul, too. So those things are in our animal soul. That's part of the animal soul. Okay. That's an animating life force. That's what keeps us alive, right? And it's through that the neshama is attached to the body. So that nefesh is attached to our blood, and the neshama is attached to that nefesh. So so you'll see also in Jewish law that we don't drink blood of other animals. My husband is an attorney, and one of his hobbies actually is kosher meat, not killing it, but helping people sell it, which is now part of his business. He's a real estate and lending lawyer, but he does some kosher, whatever, it's a whole long story. But anyway, there's a kosher bison plant that employed, among the employees was a Native American who felt a connection to the bison, right, as a Native American. And he asked for permission to drink a cup of blood. So they looked into it and they said, you know, look, I mean, we are not allowed to sell it, you know, but you can take it if you want. You work in the plant. I'm not going to prevent you from collecting the cup. He drank it. The owner of the plant said that guy was full of energy for weeks. It gave him such a life force, which is what he wanted. This Native American understood that the bison as a holy animal to them, drinking their blood will bring some of the bison into him, and that energy will be integrated into his body. That's what he was after. But he said it was amazing to see the level of energy this guy had after he drank that cup of blood. Blah. Right? We don't do that. Jewishly, we're not about, you know, we understand that that does hold a life force that's not ours to imbibe. We're not permitted to, according to Jewish law. So It's attached to the blood. The neshama is attached to the nefesh. Now let's look at the neshama, this whole piece of five layers. So we have five chunks. Imagine links in a chain. So you have five links that it's one chain when you hold it up, but each link is its own separate thing, but they're all attached to each other. So imagine it like that. So of these links, we go from the lowest level and to the highest level, even though on the paper we're going from highest to lowest, but really we're going from lowest level to highest level. So nefesh is the lowest level. Nefesh is that part of the neshama that rests up against our body. Nefesh means to rest. Nefesh, nofesh is a holiday. Or it also means desire. Im yeshet nafshi, right? That I desire something. So it has to do with your personality, that part that you're most in contact with of your spiritual self. That part that we feel the most often. When we feel spiritual, it's most often in that nefesh part. However, let's skip the next one for a second, the ruach, and go into the neshama level. Neshama is the third level, and that's where our spiritual aspirations reside. So we may feel into that. We don't always feel into that. We sometimes feel pulled by that. So we feel its pull in our life. But unless we're feeling very sensitive, or just those few times when we really feel we had an extra special davening somewhere, there was, or a child is born, a grandchild is born, like those, one of those moments where you really feel deeply, that's when you're feeling your neshama, that third level. Otherwise, usually you just feel its effects. You feel a pull in you. Sometimes even Rabbi Akiva Tatz talks about, sometimes when we're looking into retail therapy, right? So I saw a great comic in the New Yorker that had an actual therapist, and somebody's lying on the couch. I don't think anybody lies on couches anymore, but in the pictures they do. Right? So the therapist has her legs crossed with her notebook, and the person's telling the story, and the caption is, "Have you considered shopping?" Right? So have you considered shopping? Well, so what is it about shopping? What does shopping do? So Rabbi Akiva Tatz explains that shopping is acquisition. It's acquiring things, making things yours. And when the soul is hungry, it wants you to acquire. It's asking you really to acquire mitzvos, acquire good deeds, acquire spiritual growth, acquire spiritual knowledge. But all you feel is the hunger. You feel the void. So it works to go shopping. Right? Because you want to acquire. So, or it works to eat also because you want to acquire. So eating and shopping are both ways that you might be trying to quell the pull of the neshama in your life. So you're not necessarily feeling the neshama, but you're feeling the pull sometimes. Okay, nefesh. So back to, no, ruach, back to that middle one in between nefesh and neshama. Ruach means wind or spirit. It's by its nature unstable. And this part of the neshama flits between the nefesh and the neshama, goes back and forth, and mediates between them so that the personality is affected by the neshama, and so that the neshama can bring its pull down, and it just goes back and forth. So it helps you feel that unstable sense of I want to go somewhere, but it also helps bring the neshama's pull down. That's how it functions. The Chaya and the Yechida are two levels above that. And those are areas that we pretty much don't feel into at all. You have to be, I don't know who is sensitive enough, but it's not for the regular person to feel it, although we feel the influence of it.
What about in dream state?
In dream state, they can affect us, but we don't feel it.
How would you define each?
Okay, so how would I define each? I wouldn't. But I'll tell you how they both work. Or a way that they both work in our lives is in dream state. So we do understand that when we're sleeping, we're considered 1/60th dead. So 1/60th is a number that's real, but not tasted. Can't feel it.
Oh.
Right? So that's why we have in kashrus, we have the measure of 1/60th, right? You're making hot chocolate on the stove for the kids who are outside playing, and chicken soup. Right, and you stir the hot chocolate, and the kids run in the door, and you spin around, and your spoon with the hot chocolate on it runs over the chicken soup top, and you dropped in 3 drops of hot chocolate into your chicken soup. Right? Is the soup kosher or treif? It's kosher, even with 3 drops of milk in it, because that's much less than 1/60th of the total quantity of it all. You can't taste it. Once you stir that soup, you can't taste it at all. It's completely nullified in it. Right? So up to 1/60th, that's the measure that could go in by mistake. and still be nullified because you can't taste it in it. Over that, you can feel it. We understand that when we visit a sick person, we take away 1/60th of their illness. So we understand it does make them better, but you can't see it necessarily on their face, right? I was wondering, like, should we go all 60 people all at once? Maybe the person will get all better. Anyway, so sleep is like 1/60th of death, right? So it's not an exact measure, but what it means is you're touching death when you're sleeping. How are you touching death? The way that you touch death when you're asleep is that the bonds that hold your neshama attached to your body loosen. And parts of your neshama can float away while you're sleeping. Particularly chaya and yechida, and sometimes even neshama, can float away. So imagine, and again, these are all just parables, just for imagining, don't get tied into them, it just helps to see it. Imagine a kite with a string, right? So when you hold a string, you hold the bottom of the string, and then the kite is at the top of the string, and it can fly around, it can fly as high as the amount of string that you have let out, right? So it has the ability to fly according to the distance that you've allowed it. Now imagine your soul, so but it's still attached to you. The kite is still attached to you through the string, right? If you would let go, then it can fly away. But as long as you're holding it, it's still attached. So these levels can float away while you're sleeping, but they're still attached, like a kite on a string. What do they do when they're floating away? They can go and to visit different spiritual realms. But they need two things to visit the realms that they visit. One is a certain amount of string. They need distance. And two is a passport, a visa, really. They need a visa to enter certain spiritual realms. The amount of distance they can travel and the permission that they have to enter those spiritual realms is based on how you behaved the day before you slept that sleep where they're traveling. So however you engaged in the physical world generated a certain power that allows them to go and enter certain places. When they go and enter those certain places, they can learn things, discover things, connect with things, and bring that back down. As they come back into contact with the rest of the soul, those things can come down through the neshama, through the ruach, through the nefesh, into the lower nefesh, the animal nefesh, which then affects the imagination, and it can manifest in our dreams. Basically, we don't have prophetic dreams today. So even if we have a dream that has something real in it, there's lots of shtus in it too, lots of filler material. And so you can't always tell what's filler and what's real. But sometimes when you do get an insight like that, that's so clear and you know it's true, whether it comes in a dream or comes in an awake state, it can be from the action of these that have been up high and gained some information, and it filters down like that, and you can get that insight like that because it was gifted to you.
Is that where, like, deja vu, that kind of thing comes from?
I'm not sure about deja vu. So I just don't know.
You feel like you've been there before, right? You've seen it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's possible that that's one place it comes from, and there's chemical things about deja vu too, how that works in the brain. But it's possible that there is some of this because you can see things, and then I think you can, but I don't know for sure, transcend time and see some things at some. You can gain insights depending on what you're allowed to gain that might include deja vu as an experience of it. Okay. How much more time do we have? Still a few more minutes, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about soul entrance and soul exit for a minute. So how does the soul come in? So we said 40 days, but it turns out that the soul does not fully come in at 40 days. Now, I did some of this research because we had twin granddaughters in the fall, and unfortunately one did not make it, died after 2 weeks.
Sorry.
So she was buried, thank you, so she was buried after 2 weeks, which is under 30 days. Under 30 days, when a Jew is buried under 30 days, there's different halachas, different laws. There's no ritual washing. There's no tahara. There's no tachrichim, the ritual clothing that they wear. There's no coffin. There's no kaddish. There's no kel mali rachamim. There's no stone. Nothing. There's no funeral. So it was fascinating. I mean, like, it was sad, but interesting to, like, watch the whole process. You know, I'm inside of myself and outside of myself at the same time while this is happening. But I wanted to learn more about it so that Rav, as she was dying, before he wrapped her up and before we went to go bury her, he sat with the grandparents to give us some perspective on what was going on. And he said that basically her soul never really made it into the world all the way. that she just passed through the world from one level of Gan Eden to the next, and that she just needed to come through. And the truth is, if there wasn't medical help like there is today, she would have been a stillbirth. They sort of like dragged her into the world for 2 weeks before she finally was set free. But she touched through the physical and then back out. So because that's what happened, her soul didn't accrue anything through its contact with the physical that needed a spiritual fixing. And all the burial things that we do have to do with fixing the neshama through physical pathways that other people can do for you. So the washing, the clothing, the coffin, the funeral, the kaddish, all that stuff, even the gathering of people to send you off into the next world, all of that is about fixing the soul, which wasn't necessary for her. So the soul comes in at 40 days. It's when it starts coming in, but it turns out there's a long coming in process. So the next chunk of that comes in is at birth. And the next chunk that comes in is at 30 days. Now there's a little fuzziness, but it's possible that the next chunk that comes in by pieces, but around 3 years. So 3 years is called ben chinuch, when you're obligated to start educating. Right, so there's a difference in the quality of a child before and after 3 years old. So that's a possible next stage. And then the next stage is 12 or 13, depending on if they're male or female, bar bat mitzvah. And the final stage, when the soul's fully in, is age 20. Mm-hmm. Age 20. Right?
What is it after 30 days?
After 30 days is...
3 years?
3 years, bar bat mitzvah, age 20. Age 20 is called Bar Onshim, the age of punishment. Age of Bar and Bat Mitzvah is when a person is considered an adult. Anybody here who has Bar or Bat Mitzvah, somebody, or who has been a Bar or Bat Mitzvah, totally knows that 12 and 13 is so not an adult, try as you might, right? I, for sure, thought I was at 12, 100% grown up, but turns out, in retrospect, I see that I wasn't. 20 is closer, even though today, those of us who are over 20 may look at 20-year-olds and think, cute, you think you're grown up, but you're not. However, 20 is different than 12, for sure. So what is the difference? At 12 or 13, we are held halachically, we're viewed halachically as adults in terms of our interpersonal relationships. So you're held accountable for theft, for harming people with your words, for anything that has to do with another person. However, even though you're trying your best to keep the laws between you and God, you're not held fully punishable, don't tell this to kids, until you're 20. So the 17-year-old who sleeps through Shacharis, not the same thing as the 21-year-old who sleeps through Shacharis, right? They're not fully... 20 is when the full weight of the law comes to bear because the full neshama has come into the body. So that's the entrance process. Let's look at the exit process. How does the soul go out? So the Gemara tells us about a spectrum of exit experiences. So the spectrum can be from as easy as removing a hair from a bowl of milk, just slipping out like that. So easy, so painless, so natural. All the way to removing a seed from cotton. Mm-hmm. Right? Which is, if anybody's ever tried that in a restoration village or something, you have to pull so hard. The seed is so enmeshed in those fibers. It's really actually quite a bit of work. It's interesting when you read about slavery, how the slaves had to harvest cotton and then at the end of the day seed it. You know, how you think about how mean that was. It doesn't seem so mean until you try it once and you realize how much work that is with your fingers already bloody at the end of the day having harvested, and how the cotton gin must have transformed the world. But anyway, that's how hard it could be. It's so hard to pull it out, right? So that's the spectrum of the exit, what it could be like. So what does that look like, resting out?
The soul from the body.
The soul from the body. But so cotton, seed out of cotton, what could that look like? That could look like a long death, right? Several months in a coma or suffering or in pain or cancer or whatever it is. It takes a long time for it to come out, as opposed to certainly the most peaceful death, just in one's sleep. You know, somebody goes and lies down and never wakes up. That's the easiest, right? And it just slips out. And anything in between that in the spectrum. So it turns out the death starts. The definition of death for this is the soul leaving the body. When the soul and the body are separate, that's death, right? So it turns out that it can start before actual death. And anybody who's watched somebody die, mm-hmm. right, can see the bonds of the soul loosening from the body in the weeks before, the days before. You see it in their face. They're still alive and breathing, but their soul's not fully attached. You can definitely see that in somebody who's dying, right? We don't call that dead yet, but you see the process is beginning there, starting to loosen. And then with the last breath, the soul is out, but still hovering. So the full exit takes a year. But so it starts with the death, starts with it loosening, and then death. And then burial is the next stage of where the bonds separate a little further. So it goes by the halachic stages of a year, right? So then burial, and then the end of Shiva. You know, the soul of the departed is in the Shiva house.
Right.
So even if you, I learned this from paying a Shiva call on somebody who was sitting Shiva alone. So I was the only one in the room with her, and so I speak Hebrew, so I translated the Hamakom Yinechem Etchem B'toch Sharev Leitzion V'Yerushalayim into the singular, and I said, Hamakom Yinechem Otach B'toch Sharev Leitzion V'Yerushalayim, and she said, no, you're not allowed to say it in the singular, because the neshama of the departed is here too, and you're comforting both of us. Because the neshama is also having a hard time leaving behind what it knew.
Can you say in English what you said?
Yeah, that the thank you, that the omnipresent should comfort you in the company of the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. Right, so that's the phrase that we say when we leave a Shiva house, but it doesn't translate so well in English, because you in English is singular or plural, unlike in the South. When my daughter went, my daughter took a Hebrew test in the South, right? So she had to translate you masculine, you feminine, y'all masculine, y'all feminine. So they have a way to say it, right? Yeah. So it really should be, may the omnipresent comfort y'all among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. So it should be in the plural. Okay, so that's the end of Shiva. And then 30 days is another separation period. And then finally, at the end of the year, is the final separation.
Are there stories about people feeling the presence of the neshama in the Shiva year?
For sure. I mean, so it's interesting to hear just anecdotal, and I can't give you a whole, you know, scientific analysis of it, but definitely people who have experienced a loss, a live person, the person who's left behind, have, those who have some contact with the memory, with the neshama, with that person, it's much more in the beginning part of the year, and less as the year goes on. And then occasionally, it could be after that year, but it's much, much less, and any visions that they have from people I've spoken to, it's less clear. They don't see, like, it may be the first month, their mother comes to them and says, remember the chicken soup in the back of the freezer? And they're like, I didn't know, right? But it's a clear image. But by the second year, right, after they gave birth and they wish they could tell their mother or whatever it is, all they see is like a wispy thing. Like, it's not their mom. It's their mom's energy is there. So, and that's, it gets rarer and rarer. Actually, I have a story of a friend who's a Baal Tshuva. In high school, she dated somebody, and then she lost touch with him completely, became frum, and then one day she had a dream, and her high school boyfriend's brother came to her and said, next week is my Yahrzeit. I need somebody to say Kaddish. And she woke up and freaked out. She's like, what? This guy's probably 28, you know? And so she just like... forgot about it, and the next night she had the same dream, three nights in a row. A clear picture of this. She hadn't spoken to this guy in 10 years, right? But so then she said, okay, I had this dream three nights in a row. I have to like look up my old boyfriend. So she finds him, and it turns out his brother had died in a car accident almost a year ago. And he was Jewish. And she was the only frum person, the only observant person, that he knew on this side. So he contacted her to say, there's such a thing as Kaddish, and I need it said for me. So she was able to arrange it.
Wow.
Could you imagine? Right, so there are things like that. And there's other kinds of stories. I mean, that's just a story I know of. I know the person that it happened to. But there's stories that you can read in other books about the types of contact. We do have a concept of contact like that, and it becomes less and less. Certainly as the souls go up and up. So they go up in their levels. On Yom Kippur, we call Yom Kippur, and also Yom HaKippurim. Right? One reason why it's called Yom HaKippurim is because it's Mechaper, it atones for both the living and the dead. You might say, what do the dead need atonement for? They've been dead since last Yom Kippur, right? Those people who have been dead for year after year after year. Why are you still trying to atone for your mother who's been dead for 10 years? What did she do last year? I understand myself. I made these commitments. I didn't keep them. I made mistakes. You know, I need a new atonement this year. But she's been dead. What did she do already? However, what she did do was create ripple effects in the world. Ripples for good and ripples for bad. So the same way she yelled at you and didn't appreciate something is the same way you're yelling at your daughter, because that's what you imbibed from her. So your daughter's hurt feelings accrue back to your mom. And she does need atonement for that. Right? And the ripples go out. And positive, too. She taught you to give tzedakah, to make sure that you carefully tithe your money. You have a separate account, even. You're so careful, because she was so careful. And so everybody who hears how you have a separate account where you always separate 10%, and you have a checkbook for that account, you always know what's in it, and you know how to give from that, and it's an amazing thing. And anybody who hears that story sets up their own account, that also accrues back to your mother. She goes up higher and higher every time somebody sets up a special account because they heard of that story of your mom who did it, right? So the good and the bad continue to ripple and ripple and ripple and ripple until the end of time. But time does end, and then there's another judgment at the end of time after the world is finished. So there's a judgment there. Okay. We have to finish up, but let me just go through this, okay? So what's the point then? So we're a soul before we're born, and we're a soul after we die, and we dip into this world wearing a physical body, living in the physical zone for a certain period of time. What are we doing this for? Any ideas?
Soul correction.
Why does the soul need to be corrected?
Because when you said, like, we didn't accomplish everything we needed.
Well, let's say it's a fresh soul, going back before we messed things up.
So it can go back and piece back together into one soul?
It's really to move. It's to transform. Soul transformation is better. Than correction. Because let's say it's a fresh soul coming in.
But I thought we're only recycled souls.
We are right now.
Oh, but you're talking way back.
Yeah. What's the whole point of a physical world and bodies? What did God do this for? Right? Yeah, you can see that you need to fix things up once you ruin things. But what's the whole point of setting up the whole system? So the whole system is set up because, like angels who have no free will and can't do anything, mm-hmm. spiritual creatures can't do anything on their own. They mm-hmm. have to be blended with the physical. Physical can move and spiritual cannot. Spiritual is static, really, except for how it's attached to the physical, which makes it dynamic. So in order for the soul to transform, in order really for us to make a relationship with the divine, to actually move into relationship and choose it, we have to have a physical world. We have to have a body. We have to have physical tools. That's body and arena in which our body functions. Century and country and laws, you know, just how we are, where we are at this point in time is our physical arena. And we're supposed to use that to transform our soul so that our soul comes in one way and hopefully exits another. Mm-hmm. We don't want it just to shepherd it and let it be how it came in. Let's say we came in kind and sweet and loving and forgiving, right? And we exit the same way? Great. What'd you accomplish? Okay, so you didn't ruin yourself. But you didn't go anywhere either. The trick is to transform, right? To make some distance between how you come in and how you exit. So that's what we're trying to accomplish, is to transform ourselves so that we're in a relationship of our own choosing with the divine forever. Because that's what the world to come is living inside the relationship that we created in this world. So soul lives forever in relationship with the divine, but only lives in the relationship that body helps soul accomplish. So you have to have body and soul together to create that relationship. So we have all these tools. We discussed some of the tools. Our actual body, how our body works is one of our tools. Whether we have high blood pressure or bad eyes or terrible allergies or learning abilities or disabilities, whatever it is, our body is one of our tools. And then our environment, our parenting, our socioeconomic status, our whatever it is, everything that's around us is all our tool package. How can we work through these things, with these things, to create this transformation? And through that, we want to see the relationship between spiritual and physical. Many religions put it on a spectrum and say physical's on one side and spiritual's on the other. And so the further you move from one, the closer you get to the other. We see that sometimes, but in general, we see it much more this way, that the physical is the gateway to the spiritual. that you have to use the physical to access the spiritual. That's why we have mitzvahs that are physical things, physical pathways to spiritual goals. That's what a mitzvah is, something you do physically that transforms you spiritually. So that's what we're trying to accomplish. That's why at the bottom I said, ready, set, grow, to see your world as a soul workshop. That's really what we're here for, is to see everything is about how can we grow through this? How can we use everything that we have, our marriage or our lack thereof, our children or our lack thereof, their compliance or their lack thereof, right? Our money or our lack thereof. Whatever it is, everything that we have and that we don't have is there for us to use as a physical gateway to a spiritual destination. It's all about how do we grow our soul? How do we use this to grow who we are? I think we should probably end there, even though there's so much more to say. But I think that's... You're free to ask any questions that you want.
Can you repeat? You said we must work in partnership. The physical is the gateway to the spiritual, mm-hmm. which is what mitzvahs are about. And you said mitzvahs are physical act which allows you to...
Physical pathway to a spiritual goal. That's my definition for a mitzvah. Physical pathway to spiritual goal. Because we know that the root of the word mitzvah shares the root with pliers, you know, something that brings two ends together. It's an Aramaic tzivta, something like that. It means bring together.
Staff is tzevet.
Tzevet is staff. That's something you bring
mitzvot,
together.
Okay.
Right? Mitzvot is something that brings together. Pliers, it's something that brings together.
Okay, so physical pathway to spiritual goal.
Right, so the mitzvah brings together the physical and the spiritual. Right, it bonds physical and spiritual and brings you together with Hashem. So that's what every mitzvah is a physical pathway to a spiritual goal. Something that you do to create a spiritual effect. And Hashem is the one who understands the spiritual effects. It's nice. I mean, I think about sometimes spiritual pharmacology. Right, so with physical pharmacology, you don't have to know how Advil works for it to work. All you have to do is swallow it, right? So if your kid comes to you and says, I stubbed my toe, it really hurts, you could say, take an Advil, and they'll say, oh, it works on toes too, right? So we know that Advil blocks pain in the brain, not that it goes to your head to make you feel better, right? It doesn't go to your toe, it blocks. We know that much about it. But, and the kid doesn't, all they have to do is swallow it and it works, right? So, but we could learn everything that on how all other drugs work. If we get really sick, we go to somebody who already studied that and they recommend for us what works well. It's not that we couldn't learn it, we just haven't yet or choose not to and rely on an expert. Same thing with mitzvahs. Mitzvahs have a way of working on your soul. You don't have to know how it works for it to work. You just have to do it. That's all. And you have to do it according to halacha. When you do it according to Jewish law, then you create that effect on your soul. You could learn how each mitzvah works. It's a lot of work, but it's for sure available to you. Just like becoming a neurosurgeon, you could learn how to do that. It's available to you. You have the brain. You have the capacity to learn it all. Let's say you choose to learn something else with your time or spend your time differently. Turns out there are people who have spent time learning how all those mitzvahs work, and you can go to one of them. Some of them are called rabbis. Some of them are called other things. Not all rabbis know all this stuff, but... how each mitzvah works, but they can guide you in making them work for you inside your body, on your soul. So you can rely on somebody else who's gained that information while you're gaining the information that you want to gain. But it's an interesting thing to think about. How do I grow my soul using my physical world? Mitzvahs are your starting point.
A lot of information.
Yeah, it's a lot of information. It's a good thing we recorded it. Okay, yeah. Okay, great. Thanks.